So, Dr. Flower, welcome to FSU. We're so excited to have you here.
Thank you. I've been so nicely treated.
Oh, good, good.
Oh, shucks.
We try to be nice.
All right, so we start off pretty general. We're curious about how you got into writing or literacy studies.
That has a lot to do with the state of rhetoric and literacy studies at the time I finished my degree, which... I did a dissertation on Dickens, and I had a great time. And I got a job as a kind of fill-in person for the department head at CMU. So I had a kind of nice year there. I was finishing my dissertation and teaching there, and Tim was had a new job at the University of Pittsburgh, so we moved to Pittsburgh. And so when that year was up, I needed to find, a real job, and they weren't offering ones in the English department, but the business school next door there decided that since Wharton and Harvard had business writing programs, they needed to start one too. And I had almost no knowledge of business writing, and what I could find out in the field, it seemed to be genre studies, which were a great yawn, and these were masters in professional writing who were going to go off and make mega bucks after their MBA. These were MBA students in a pretty high-powered business school. And so, but I started teaching this course that people didn't have to take for credit. They only came if they saw it as really useful. And so that was a really good challenge. And so I started figuring out, besides these genre things, what I could teach that would really make them think that there was something, some substance there. So I started going to the psychology and linguistics lectures, and I was finding things in linguistics about, how passes affect processing time by a good number of milliseconds. And that was, that seemed to be a basis for making, some kind of recommendation, but it wasn't quite enough. And then I started finding out about the work in cognitive psychology and problem solving. And Dick Hayes had done some work with designers, and Herb Simon did a lot of work with chess players, and so there was a kind of interesting research agenda there about problem solving and thinking, and that certainly made sense to me. Mm. So it was really a process of partly educating myself, and then Dick Hayes and I started talking, and so we kind of decided we just kind of see where it would go, and so we would get together every week and talk about issues in writing, and so I started, looking at problem solving patterns and finding a way to kind of teach that, and I think it was because of the exigence of having to teach people who really, who they weren't having to learn what I had taught as a TA at Rutgers, which was how to be a literary critic, and or what I could already do, and I think that was a really good challenge. And I started writing the problem-solving book as a textbook because I kept trying to find really useful things that would teach people how to think their way through some of these problems. And so that's what got me into looking at that and Richard Young's rhetoric discovery and change that somebody there at CMU was teaching from, kind of an amazing kind of coincidence. And he told me about that, and he just like opened a really interesting door. So that's kind of how I got into teaching in rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So tagmatics as well. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting.
I didn't really do much with tagmimics, but
sure. Yeah. it's an interesting sort of. Sphere of influence.
And what Richard was saying there was that you start with a problem, and that was what I was kind of channeling Richard in our class. In our class discussion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. The second question here is, in community literacy, especially, you mentioned Wayne Peck as an influence on your more recent work, and we were really interested in about this relationship with Peck. And also, what other scholars in the field have influenced your thinking as well?
Well, the relationship with Wayne was just another piece of wonderful serendipity. Because
yeah.
I've been working with the standard subject pool, you know, the college, you know, sophomore and so forth. And Wayne was, he'd done his Harvard MDiv, and he was the director of the community house and the pastor of a Presbyterian church on the north side. And he decided to get his PhD in rhetoric. So that's how I got to know him. And we went to a national reading conference in Tucson. And we took a dawn walk together. And this is just this wonderful event in which he convinced me that instead of studying Carnegie Mellon students, why not study the young people he was working with on the north side? And that seemed like a really good idea, because I knew the CMU students were going to do fine, but these kids might not. And so could I take the very things I was teaching at Carnegie Mellon and make them work in a place where it might make a even more valuable difference? Mm-hmm. So out of that, we just started piloting things and trying out things. And so he has been a good friend and a kind of continuing inspiration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we work together on supporting each other on things that we're doing. But I think the kind of miracle for me was to be able to run into, work with him and Joyce Baskins at the on the north side, that brought together, you know, what I could do and the real incredibly wonderful and different strengths the two of them had. So it was just a really good synergy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, I think that's hard to replicate. I think that was a really, marvelous opportunity.
Yeah, I get the sense in the book that's you realize that that's sort of a very rare experience, and that you really deeply appreciate
mm-hmm.
sort of that.
But you know, I've been talking to other people too. I mean, that had a lot of things going for it. But people who build connections, Dave Coogan is a good example of who build real connections in a community, and you notice that the projects kind of keep morphing.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of thing you do, it's not Jeff Grable argues for going institutional, and Paul Matthau argues for doing street literacy. And this is somewhere in between. This is really finding a set of colleagues and readapting your ideas, transferring them, taking what works, putting it in a new context. So it's much more like a kind of sustained inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's certainly a kind of replicable model.
Absolutely. I'm going off list.
No.
One of the things I noticed about this book, why don't you care? Well, you make a comment that really stuck out for me was talking about sort of moving from students in the university environment to the people in
the writers,
the writers,
teenage
industry,
writers,
right?
Yeah.
That you make this distinction that there's a kind of change in the academic environment with the students, but then there's some sort of genuine change. That's you say genuine change.
Well,
in the,
I meant genuinely larger social change.
Yeah.
I
just thought that
ahead.
Division was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions I had in regards to that section was, Is there a possibility for an equivalent genuine change in the academic environment that echoes what you see
mm-hmm.
in the teenage writers?
I don't think I must have misspoke. I mean, I think that if you're looking at places where your work might make a bigger difference for someone, I think Carnegie Mellon students it makes a difference for. I mean, I think that was a useful approach. Our freshman writing program was kind of organized around that. But I'm looking at people who have got it going, you know, and have got all this kind of support and stuff. And I'm looking
right.
then, you know, and I could continue to do my research with improving things for university students. But it looked to me like, given the chance I had to do research, because I was a co-director at the National Center for Writing and Literacy with Berkeley at that time, and so I had this opportunity to put research in a set of questions and a situation that hadn't been really studied, mm-hmm. and partly to just show the potential and the kind of intelligence and the, you know, what these kids could do, mm-hmm. which their schools were not telling them they could do. Right. And so it just seemed, you know, it seemed to me a place where if you wanted to make a difference, I had an opportunity to a place that was going to make a bigger difference.
I love that. I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Our next question is, how about life experiences? How have they shaped your thinking?
Oh, Lord. What does that mean?
I don't know. I guess it means if you think, are there any life experiences that stand out? I mean, what you said, your experience with Wayne Peck.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe other experiences that led you when you were working more in the cognitive.
Okay.
Or even with your more recent work.
So I'm trying to think of what, you know, what is significant about this question that would be useful to anybody. I mean, what immediately comes to mind are all the horse packing trips with graduate students. Those were wonderful life experiences talking about ideas and riding in the woods in Colorado. But I don't think that's what you have in mind.
You went horseback riding with your graduate students?
Well, it became kind of a thing that...
Well, not a whole crowd.
The people who worked with me eventually started, because we would go on horsepacking trips every year in northern Pennsylvania, and we did one with, and John Ackerman came on one with us in Colorado as well. That was a really nice way to you talk about rhetoric over a campfire, you know, and a few beers. And okay, but then now let's see. What do you really need out of this? What would be useful?
Well, I think some of it, you don't have to worry about how useful it is. It's just kind of giving us a broader perspective.
Maybe looking
maybe.
For a worldview, like what
yeah.
has shaped your thinking in terms of maybe worldview. But I think the Wayne Peck.
Oh, well, you know, Wayne Peck, clearly that and... Wayne Peck and Cornel West have been tremendously influential in my thinking, that kind of prophetic pragmatism,
mm-hmm.
and finding a kind of moral core or calling that combines, you know, rigorous thinking. Like Tim, I'd been part of a church when I was a kid, and then suddenly I got to this age of accountability that says, I can't believe this theology.
You know,
I'm sorry.
Those
yeah.
Limited,
yeah. And then working with Wayne and finding kind of a progressive theology that had that kind of sense of a call
mm-hmm.
behind it. And that has been a, you know, a tremendous, you know, kind of force for me of the kind of intellectually challenging side of that and being part of a church that is... that Wayne's the pastor of, that right now we're taking a lot of leadership in the city on LGBT issues, as well as working with his project on telling our stories with kids. So that's one of those things that kind of sustains you in saying what matters.
Mm-hmm.
And Dewey and Cornel West, I think, have been just really influential in my thinking.
We also learned from the kids.
Yeah.
And that was really good.
Oh.
Yeah, it wasn't top-down stuff. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know
mm-hmm.
now I'm going to introduce you to this, and here it is, and
mm-hmm.
here are the authorities, and all that. What about
yeah, right.
Everybody else.
And it was really great seeing those kids in
yeah.
the Literacy Center, we call them writers, the Decision Makers group, we call them scholars. For me, just being able to cross a real cultural boundary
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
feel welcomed and being
appreciate
a learner, and you know, that was that I think I'm just so lucky to have had that experience, I guess. But that affects your sense of what you need to know, and that other discourses, other ways of talking, and that really goes into the public deliberation
mm-hmm.
work as well, I think. But I don't know if I've got good life experiences. Yeah.
Somehow we doubt
that. I think we
would
debate that with you.
What first drew you to the study of language?
I started in chemistry in high school, in college, because it was the only hard course in high school. And I thought, well, this is obviously the thing to study. And but, you know, I got in this advanced chemistry course, and we were learning, you know, kind of theories of atoms and stuff, and I couldn't see the practical applications I wanted to add.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started taking these literature courses, and this was so much fun. And it was like this great big secret that, you know, I could do this fun stuff, and then
yep.
they call it a major. And, yeah, and then I was going to go to England, but then I got itchy feet, and so I went to Boston after my first 3 years, and I needed to see the world and look at the Atlantic Ocean. I read too much Thoreau and Emerson, and Tim had driven across country on his motorcycle. It was destiny. We were destined to meet we were working in a bookstore together.
Pacific Ocean to the next
yeah.
bookstore.
You met at a bookstore in
where we
Boston.
Were working. Yeah,
that's awesome.
In Harvard Square. We were both working in this Harvard Square bookstore.
But we didn't hit it off right at first, because I was a professional. You know,
he managed a bookstore at Stanford.
I was
and,
one
know,
of the managers
I mean,
at the
department.
Big Stanford bookstore and all that. And here is Linda, who wanted to read books, for God's sake.
I'd hide
she'd
up in the...
sneak around. She'd go up for
yeah.
sure.
I wasn't the best of,
sure.
of employees, but yeah.
And, on her last day there, on Saturday, I surprised myself and her, I guess. Asked her out to lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the rest is the next day he just showed up with the motorcycle and we went out in the woods and that was it. So, yeah. So there's a life experience for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's a good one.
Yeah.
A good one.
And he was and we support each other through graduate school.
Yeah.
Like I think many
yeah.
people do.
Mm-hmm.
So he did
yeah.
his and I was working in publishing and I felt my mind going dead. And that was a life experience. I said, I got to get back in school.
That's right.
You know, I think that's why a lot of us are here.
Yeah.
We just want to be
so
perpetually in school and studying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. She's looking at me right now.
No.
Yeah. But you're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. All right. So the next question we have on our list, what classes do you teach?
Oh.
Which are your favorites and why? I know you mentioned in Dr. Fleckenstein's class earlier that you teach academic classes still. So what are we
oh, doing? Yeah. Well, the process of reading and writing, that
mm-hmm.
really does this cognitive work. Where we learn how to collect data on what readers are actually doing and making at it, this constructive work of these readers. And then in the second half, we collect data on ourselves as writers over a project that expands for that whole period of the second half of the course. So people are collecting, thinking a lot of protocols, planning tapes, retrospectives, rhetorical reading kinds of things, and developing this. So that is the most fun because people are really discovering neat things, and they're learning to try to use these methods and see what they get out of them. So that's
a graduate level class?
No, I get PhDs. I love mixed classes.
Okay.
I've got
yeah.
I've had sophomores in that class,
mm-hmm.
And it's a little rough going for some people. But right now, I've got computer scientists, psychologists, linguists. And I kind of designed part for professional writers as well. And that kind of crossover of people with different kinds of connections, both to research and the kind of writing they do, is really neat.
Mm-hmm.
Because you see people looking at their own strategies and assumptions that they bring from wildly different backgrounds. The other course I teach is the literacy course. And That one starts out with reading Walter Ong, and, you know, the Great Divide theorists, the Great Leap theorists, and Jack Goody, Scribner and Coles, kind of blowing them out of the water in terms of, you know, literacy is not the only thing. I would read James G., Glenda Hull, we use Ellen Cushman's really wonderful anthology. And so we really look at those kinds of issues, Shirley Heath, and then we start doing the Decision Makers Project about midway through, and so that takes about maybe a third of the class days to that, but it's really kind of taking literacy and looking at people, different kinds of literacy, and doing a final project on what accounts as literate achievement, because the debates about literacy, they're really around, you know, what matters that you could do with this, and people just have radically different notions. And so my students have often done projects on, you know, different kinds of marginalized literacy, including things like reading the racing forms, which turns out to be really complicated, literacy people bring to kind of social work kinds of things. You know, what do you need to know, and or how to do crits in design, or how do you enter the literate discussion of being an opera singer, and you know all the kinds of things. You know, the topoi and the ways that you learn a discourse of doing, thinking, believing, you know, the kind of James G. stuff. So, and then we work on decision-making with the scholars. So that's a great deal of fun. Another course I really like is environmental rhetoric. We read a lot of Jimmy Killingsworth's book is really good. And so I use that, kind of the history of whole environmental rhetoric. If you're ever interested in a course like that, that's a great kind of foundation. But we read Aldo Leopold and John Muir and Thoreau, and then we get into all the kind of public debates. Right now it's around fracking and coal and gas exploration. So we look at, you know, Josh Fox's film Gasland. So we've got a whole spectrum of things. But then people have to write as a consultant, and look at the various rhetorical strategies people are using to build arguments in this arena, and help somebody. Usually people hook up with a nonprofit. They don't necessarily make real, it's not like an internship, but they write for like the Sierra Club or the mayor's office that hadn't figured out how to really teach recycling. So they try to, they're studying a set of rhetorical strategies that they really learn how to both see these and use them. So they're trying to do something useful with that. And I'll talk this afternoon about the Leadership Dialogue and Change course. That's where the think tanks come out.
Wow, fantastic.
I know.
Oh, and the New Public Sphere. Oh, that is so much fun. That's Habermas. And, you know, we kind of get through that stuff, and then we start looking at local public spheres and deliberation, and people find a local public and actually, you know, study what they're doing, and looking at questions like, well, is deliberation really possible in these, and how do people create these local publics and deliberation? So that's the kind of public sphere theory stuff.
So do you teach
Two and two. So it's just kind of rotate around them.
Busy.
Yeah.
Happy.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on evaluating students in your classroom when they produce writing or they're going out into the community? How do you, I guess, see yourself as, you know, because you are an authority figure, at the same time trying to empower them to do this really meaningful work?
So which kind of students are you thinking about? Are you talking about assessing, because it varies a lot on what they're trying to do. So you're thinking about, well, tell me a little more about what you...
You mean what level student?
Or like the writing they do in the environment?
Well, I guess I'm not sure. I was just thinking at some point you have to evaluate their students' performance in the classrooms. And I was curious to how you do that or what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I cause pain. I mean, I have pretty complicated rubrics for writing. that I really expect people to kind of name problems and do that kind of analysis and then use like in the process course, I was asking them to read some theories and then turn them into a tool for research and really show what you could discover by looking at a text with this theory as a way to uncover how it was working. And so I just gave about half the papers back and said, let's try this again. and it could have been, we had an interesting discussion about whether it was my assignment or you know, the task representation problem of, you know, people not really using it as a tool to go discover something. Because I've got a pretty strong demand that you don't summarize information and you don't repeat theory. You really use it in a way that teaches us all something. So I've got a very, I think, strong sense of rhetorical significance. Is this, and, you know, one way that really supports that is having people give short presentations about what's going to be the point. You know, it's like when you're giving a professional briefing as a consultant. You give your analysis and your kind of key diagnosis of what the issues are, and then they decide if they want to hire you as a consultant. And so I put a lot of emphasis on things like considering alternative points of view, building arguments. So all these courses, they kind of have two strands of people. In fact, one of the papers I use a lot is having people in the first half of a course in these courses is to write a dialogue on, like what the one right now that folks are working on is what actually, what counts as literacy. Well, that's going to depend a lot on where you are. But to bring three or four of these theorists that we've been reading or researchers and get them to talk about what counts. And so the idea is you need to be able to really understand their claims, to apply it, and talk in their voices, even if you can. And then to get them to talk back to each other with things they may not have said. So, you know, I guess I'm really interested in people using this knowledge, and I try to assess that sort of. So I think I'm pretty demanding on papers having significance and real good analysis.
Thank you. So our next question asks, what's on your nightstand? We're curious as to...
Oh, well, right...
We're talking about books there.
Well.
Yeah. Well, right now I've got Bill McKibben's Earth on there. Actually, I've also got a pile by my reading chair as well. Howard Zinn's is one of the history of
the people's history.
The people's history, yeah, that's right. And I also got a book on the Adirondacks because we go to the Adirondacks to kayak every year.
Nice.
And it was a Arpad Gessner, who was a physician, but who came and hunted and lived on a little island in the Adirondacks every summer. And it's this wonderful diary. And there's always a lot of nature stuff.
Going back to your Thoreau.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not necessarily literature. I mean, I really like natural history.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's always a kind of pile of those things there.
We all have that pile.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to read that someday.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Do you, take notes on what you read or write in the margins? Or...
Oh, absolutely. I can't imagine having
some.
A Kindle. It's just beyond me. You
I
too.
Agree.
Yeah.
Same.
I got to have a book.
I don't even really like library books for the same reason.
Yeah, I got to write it. I got to underline. Yeah. And I got to have a piece of paper. You know, what was often plagued me a lot when I was trying to, we fight over that. He doesn't write in books. He just turns the pages down, which drives me nuts. Right? And it's a sacred object.
You have to write on it instead.
Yeah, you have to write on it. Yeah, right. And, you know, and one thing that used to cause me all kinds of trouble, I'd be trying to read things and working generally on a project, and I couldn't get through the book before I had to go write something.
Yes.
You know, and these books were often just, you know, they just kind of... jumpstart
mm-hmm.
Your thinking. So I often spend the time just reading a little bit, and then, you know, you just sit and think a lot, and you have to have a tablet because you have to write
mm-hmm.
stuff down. What was the question? Where did we go on that?
What's on your nightstand?
Oh, on the nightstand, yeah, right, you know.
You actually stayed with it pretty well there, talking about what you read.
Next up is, what do you think is the most important question that students in rhetoric and composition should be considering?
Katie, hi, I have no idea.
Maybe one of the most.
Yeah. Oh, one of the most important questions.
Mm-hmm. Or an area.
What are you going to do with your work? Why do this? Aside from, of course, the secret that we want to be in school and keep learning and reading and writing.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a wonderful thing to get to do. I think that's one of the hardest things when you're a graduate student is to get out of the student absorber learner mode and to see yourself as a person who's got something to do. And that's clearly a sense of rhetoric mm-hmm. as production. And to see why your work matters. And there are lots of places it can matter in very different ways that aren't anything like necessarily working with a community group. So I think that is an essential question. You know, I think another thing that's really important is the sense of rhetoric as more than the analysis of text, but also the production of text. And I don't know, I mean, I'm just talking about the things that are really motivating to me. So what's the most important question? Because I can imagine somebody saying how we move into the 21st century and digital revolution and so forth, but that'll take care of itself. I'm not sure that's the thing we need to worry about. I don't know. What do you think?
What do I think? Well, I think that we do have some questions around who is writing where and for what, as our means of writing have shifted.
Mm-hmm.
And we have tools that are increasingly mobile, and writing takes on new meanings, and also
mm-hmm.
a new role in the production of location and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives
mm-hmm.
people, I think, a lot more agency in some ways.
Yeah.
To embrace the use of rhetoric and to make change.
Yeah, when you transcribed it, could you just kind of put and say, that's what I said? that was very eloquent.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Last question on this list.
I know, I saw the next page.
One.
Yeah.
Where do you...
Oh, God, this is another one, Martha.
She's going to ask me, okay?
Oh, this is the big
where do you see the field of literacy studies and rhetoric and composition going?
Specialist. Yeah. I'll tell you, just to be very honest, I've never really enjoyed the people who make a career of looking at their field
and
talking about what it should be doing or where it is, or I kind of want to say, get on with it. So you better not put that on there.
Okay. We can edit.
Yeah, that's right. I guess where the field is going is just never interested me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
By your work, you shall be known. You know, kind of do it. And if you want the field to go in a certain way, which I would say I do,
mm-hmm.
What you've got to figure out is how to be persuasive about that.
Maybe
which
that's
I don't
a better
think...
question, though. Where would you like to see it go as opposed to where you think it's going to go?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would like to see it go in looking at connections across different cultural and racial and socioeconomic differences in a way that values really different perspectives, and that can kind of resuscitate this sense of deliberative engagement, and that's on the one side, and the other side is really supporting the agency of people who have so much insight into problems that are plaguing us, and we're not very good at knowing how to do that kind of collaborative listening. And it seems to me that's something that rhetoric could be really good at, is teaching our students how to I don't want to say good citizens, because that's kind of a whole different paradigm, but how to have the kind of intellectually tough empathy that Christy talks about. I guess I would love to see us supporting students in enterprises like that. And it includes how do you use different technologies and mediational tools to do that. But I think it's also just at the heart of getting people to think seriously about their ability to make a difference in the world, and to see that you know they can.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for those. Now this looks intimidating, but it's really not so. So we all met a week or so ago and talked about this interview and your work and a few of your texts. And we had a discussion about sort of the trajectory of your career and sort of how they all connect and talk to each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we came up with this list of questions because we're genuinely interested in your answers. So I guess we'll just go around the room, and I don't remember who came up with what question. So, first of all, how has your conception of the rhetorical situation changed?
What rhetorical situation?
Your definition of rhetorical situation.
Mm-hmm.
Changed since your 1981 conception of it in your article with Hayes.
What was the conception of it then?
Good question.
We talked a little bit about how the rhetorical situation is kind of part of the rhetorical problem that's constructed by students. And so that there are like goals and honor-directed goals that go into that. I think at some point you talk about, you know, the monitor that kind of, you know, that we have inside of us. So we were wondering how, if you still fully support that kind of model of the rhetorical situation, or there are changes that you've made in your mind along the way.
Well, that model, the little boxes and stuff, I mean, that's a standard kind of cognitive process model of that's trying to show interrelationships between kinds of processes, and so the monitor is one of those. That was a kind of place to kind of name what really mattered. And you can see what that became was a kind of little template for research.
Mm-hmm.
So we started doing work in planning. And so I did a bunch of stuff looking at planners, and that's where the collaborative planning work came out of it. We started doing some work on revision, because that's what's really going on there. And I think a better name for the monitor stuff, I mean, that's part of a cognitive model, is there is always the monitor. But what's really interesting to me is the stuff that's up at this level that can be pushed up to consciousness. And, you know, cognitive researchers are not necessarily interested in that, but I'm interested as a rhetorician in the places where people can bring the work they're doing up to, can recognize the conflicts in their own thinking, bring it up to that negotiated construction where you're trying to figure out, what do I want to do here? And you're aware of this you want to say, or you're aware of the fact that I just don't understand this yet, or these people over here are saying that, or I want to write a paper. We're talking about the paper that's behind this talk today, and how long I've been writing it, because it has a lot of scholarly stuff in it, and I just read it and I think, oh, who's gonna keep their attention on this? And so rewriting it as a talk. And so I've been really doing a lot of kind of negotiated construction about around this paper, how to incorporate research from these other areas, and thinking people are just going to say, and so that issue of metacognition is, I think, a really important part for me. But when Dick and I started doing that, it was cognitive modeling and the kind of social issues of writing as a social process really hadn't started then. And so I think you'll see that what has expanded in the work that followed is a focus on the rhetorical situation, but also social and cultural forces and the way people are trying to deal with those. So unlike a cultural theorist, I'm not looking at those as determining forces and trying to study them. I'm interested in what people do with them and how they represent them to themselves and to what extent, you know, an ideology may exist out there, but to what extent is it actually an active part of trying to compose? Because that's a very different question. So I would say what's really changed is expanding this integrated social cognitive process with a focus on the writer. That's at the center of my vision. For somebody else, it's going to be the social situation. For somebody else, it's going to be the genre of the text and looking at the intersection of that thing. For me, it's the writer. And so you can see that thread goes through the work in deliberation and problem solving and decision making and mentoring, and just expanding the context of the kind of rhetorical issues that are out there. So, the environment is one of those things that I've always loved, you know, natural history and outdoors and stuff. And, this is probably about 5 or 10 years ago, I realized, hey, I could teach a course in this. I could call it environmental rhetoric. And Jimmy Killingsworth has written a really good book to give me a start.
Yes.
And so I think that's a little bit off the topic. But that sense of there are these wonderful exigencies out there and wonderful opportunities. And so I guess I look at research as a kind of inquiry into something that is fascinating.
And since you've talked about you still use Think Aloud protocols with your students,
mm-hmm.
so you still see that, like you did during this time, as a valid way of kind of getting at a writer's processes and trying to bring maybe some of those ideas to the conscious level, like you were thinking?
Yeah, oh, actually what I use much more now, I think Think Alouds are great research tools, but I use collaborative planning a lot. So it's like a condensed, it's like a planning process on steroids where you're trying to do it in a focused period of time. You've already done some of your work and you're getting prompted, but you're also getting you weren't there this morning. We were talking about that in some detail in this morning's class. You're also getting a way to look back at your own planning, because I ask people to tape these or GarageBand these planning sessions so that they can look at their own strategies in planning,
mm-hmm.
and look at things that are working, how they're using that planning practice and how they could make it better by level of preparation or doing it before they're too far along, that sort of thing, or noticing am I really talking about my point, or mm-hmm. am I really just kind of rehearsing my topic knowledge. So I teach it in the process class because I want people to have research tools, but I use collaborative planning in my other classes as a way to kind of support that meta-knowledge.
I think, if I can relocate it here, we talk about this one question all the time. And considering this different spaces of community literacy and the space of the academic classroom, how do you see one informing the other? We have this constant conversation here among us in reading groups and every class, actually. How do we inform?
We need Josh here. Explain. No. Yeah. You're going to tell us about spaces, right? Is this your, question? Mm-hmm. Did you come up with this?
It probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was my earlier question as well. It's sort of leading to this one. I'm sure it was.
Yeah. So when you mean the spaces of community literacy, what things are you really thinking about?
Well, I think I was probably thinking about, you make a distinction between the town and the gown in your book, which I like. And so it seems in the space of the quote-unquote
mm-hmm.
gown, there are certain affordances. And in the space of the town, there are different sort of practices and that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
And you are someone that traverses across both sides. And I'm wondering if your experiences in the space of the gown influences and talks to the
mm-hmm.
space of the town, and does it reciprocate?
Well, the first one is really easy because when I work with community literacy or with the kids who come in decision makers or in the nursing homes, you know, where we do the think tanks or, you know, those kinds of things, I come as a rhetorician.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very funny because you see the students who are being the mentors, especially at the Literacy Center, they just wanted to be cool. They wanted to fit in so badly. You know, they wanted to be accepted by the teenagers. And the teenagers kind of had their own, you know, they kind of, some of them knew each other and stuff. And so it wasn't that easy to get in, you know, as and, you know, earn your creds there. But I position myself very much as an academic with a real strategic kind of, let's now look what you can get when you learn to do this rivaling. Now come on, try it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that space, I really bring a kind of academic, critical thinking, name it, take control of it, you know? In the same way, what the community stuff, well, I think it's just changed me, but it's the same issue that when I started in the business school, is that it gives you a way to put writing in some kind of context where it makes a difference. Because I think that, I mean, I have my students write to clients all the time and in graduate courses, and you know, and they're not in professional writing, and they're thinking, what's this client stuff? But for me, I keep trying to tell them, it's a heuristic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're writing not to me, please don't write to me.
Yeah.
To somebody who needs to understand this concept, how do you teach them the idea of stasis in a way that's, that, and that probably wouldn't be the example, but teach them like a rhetorical strategy that's going to make their environmental website better. And how do you teach them to use representative anecdotes? You know, so you borrow something from Burke, but how do you, you know, and so kind of embedding the theory and research in a place where it's, where somebody's going to use it. So, in fact, Wayne does this amazing thing. He writes these incredible sermons every week. You know, it's amazing that he does that. And but like last week, he was every time he brings up some issue about something being operational, he'll kind of look at me, you know, because it's kind of a, you know, kind of a keyword. Although the other day he was using heteroglossia, and he says,
"Oh wow,
Linda, this is in the middle of the sermon,
right?"
but he was using this, you know, concept in the sermon, and so that sense of embedding rhetoric in really different communities of practice, and the literacy course makes it so clear of the I like Scribner and Cole's sense of literate practices, and that you realize the ones you have no skill in, and other people are so talented, and what the affordances are of those, and so I think that's a really important part. And also, I think as a teacher, you keep asking, what's this going to do for, you know, what are people going to be able to do when they get out of this class? So it's not a closed circle,
mm-hmm.
exactly, of learning what I feel comfortable teaching. I mean, I still, you know, I teach well. I feel comfortable teaching anyway, but because you know, you can only do what you can
right.
do. But still, I think that's a really important effect of those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think would be another way to think about that?
Well, I think why it comes up in our class, our reading group, and why we're questioning it is because, as of now, our program doesn't have the opportunity to cross the
mm-hmm.
the town and gown division.
Yeah.
And we're really interested in, here we are teaching in the classroom environment, can we start to take some of the techniques that you
mm-hmm.
have in your book
mm-hmm.
and apply them in the classroom environment and achieve that transformational more
mm-hmm.
in a classroom environment? Or are we limited by the fact that we are in a classroom?
See, I don't think so. Because, I mean, some of the projects that I did it because I had funding.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could do these as research projects. But I got to a place where I decided I'm tired of chasing funding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to do what I want to do without it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the think tanks are... you know, I did some of them as more extended projects, but I'm doing them now just as in this leadership course, the thing I'll be talking about. So that's an example of, so you hear about that. The other one that I brought was the Decision Makers project. And because I'm really, I would love to see somebody else trying this. Cause it's in the middle of a literacy class, so we're reading... and I think I already mentioned all that stuff, right? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
okay. But then the students that are, I think there's some of them from the urban schools are some of the same kids that were at the Literacy Center. They have learning disabilities. They're diagnosed now. But I think a lot of the reason the kids we were working with were so disaffected was because I think a number of them probably had some kind of difficulty processing information of, you know, one kind or another. So this project is a way for me to simply get some lab space. They come in, and I'm able to get my students to work with mentors on our scholars writing about decisions, to teach decision-making strategies on these, and to do an assessment, because I've got this database now that's now completely transferable. And so they do pre and post kinds of things, writing about them, writing about decisions and problems, and then I score them for reflective decision making, the extent to which they have right reasons, rivals, do they consider roadblocks, do they conditionalize anything, do they have any kind of reflective look at themselves. And so, you know, they get this kind of score of a level, and then this program now will turn it into pie charts, and I can do pre and post, and so I can take back this fancy assessment that's got, you know, some statistics and graphs and things about growth and decision making, but the rest part of the program is really a series of prompts and a nice little multimedia thing about people talking about decisions and learning how to rival and learning how to look at different options, and so it's just embedded in the class. And I brought the thing; it's up on the. I've got the multimedia little piece of it that's part of the website. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's loaded on the power after the talk. So if anybody wants to see it, I'd love to show you anything. She's
sure.
got it up on the and that's I've got a library I've kind of pulled together and guidebook for how to do it. So my students kind of work through this process just like there's a guidebook for doing the decision think tank stuff. Okay, so that was a long, you know, I'm kind of getting on my high horse, but I'd love to see people, you know, but it's finding a way to embed something in your class.
Yeah.
So you've got control over it, and you don't necessarily have to go to a community partner, although I think, you know, that's another, you know, finding a community partner and having a program that you do that you kind of keep refining and... You kind of test out things and then you make it better as opposed to, because these things can be so incredibly labor intensive. And that's why I do guidebooks and stuff, you know, because I like to develop a project and keep refining it so I'm not spending my time doing social negotiations, which you still do far more than you want to anyway. But, you know, like the way you can bring these students into your literacy class and do something with them, where what's really critical is they are the experts. Mm-hmm. They are writing about their own decisions, about their own lives. We don't get it. But we can help them think through how to look at that decision. Mm-hmm. And these kids, I mean, they're facing such real decisions. You know, whether it's abuse sometimes, mm-hmm. or the getting into fights, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, is there any way out of it? Or just, you know, problems of having a disability. And do you want to reveal it to your peers? And how do you handle that? And but of course you can't get help if you don't, you know. And so there's real substance there that people are working on. So I think, you know, and these are just two examples. I mean, you can think about ways that you have an intellectually substantive course, and then how would I apply it? How would I bring something? And Steve Parks is another nice example. I wouldn't do this, but he's interested in writing. He's at SUNY. He's the editor of Reflections, that journal on community literacy. He's interested in working class writers. And so what he does, he started out having students, the kind of SUNY students, Syracuse, read working class writers, but they kind of still dismiss them. Even though there were some working-class kids in the class as well. But when he started, there's a kind of collective of working-class, or writing group. When he started having these adults come in to his class and talk with his students about their writing, and the students talked about their writing, and they were on this level of equality as writers, they started to suddenly see the kinds of things that these writers were talking about. And so he found a way to create that synergy.
Fantastic.
And he's at Syracuse?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're out of time.
Oh, and some good ones coming.
Yeah. Maybe we can continue this conversation some other way.
Yes. I see you have a little more to go here.
Yeah, we've got lots of questions and thoughts. But Dr. Flower, thank you both for spending some time with us and answering our questions.
Thank
We've
so
really
much.
Enjoyed
thank
it.
You.
Had a great time.
Yeah.
And thank you once more. Thank you for coming.
Oh, good.